From KXJZ in Sacramento, I'm Jeffrey Callison. The American Heartland has a great love for school sports. A new book about two top young wrestlers in Iowa looks into this passion from close up. The author of 4 Days to Glory, today on Insight. So today, the great jazz organist, Joey DeFrancesco. He's in town for a week of concerts at Mondavi. You'll meet this master of the Hammond B3 organ. Also, we'll remember the late Jimmy Smith, another great jazz organist who was a musical mentor to Joey DeFrancesco. Smith lived many of his latter years in Sacramento. First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, jazz musician Joey DeFrancesco. He's a master of the Hammond organ, one of the definitive sounds of jazz. Plus, we'll remember Jimmy Smith, a jazz master of an earlier generation who lived many of his latter years in Sacramento. First, 4 Days to Glory, Wrestling with the Soul of the American Heartland, tells the story of two top high school wrestlers in Iowa, their quest for the state championship, and the impact that has on their lives, their friends, and their families makes for a compelling story. It was told by Mark Kreidler, a sports writer who lives in Davis. He's best known round here for his years as a sports columnist at the Sacramento Bee. He officially left the paper last Friday. Mark Kreidler also writes for ESPN. 4 Days to Glory is his first book. Mark Kreidler, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you for having me, Jeffrey. It's great to be back.
You've spent most of your career covering pro sports and big events from California. Why did you choose to write a book about high school wrestlers in Iowa?
Well, I get there's a grandiose answer, I suppose, and that is that I was looking for the last honest sport in America. But what I really was drawn to was the idea that there are still places in the country where sports, and you could pick any one, have a very special or even sacred meaning. And I think there are obvious examples, you know, high school football in Texas, basketball in Indiana. In Iowa, the sacred sport is wrestling, and they hold it close in a way that, that other people would find, I think, probably difficult to fathom, simply because it's a niche sport.
Why did wrestling become so big in Iowa?
It's a great question. There's not a clear answer, but wrestling's been in the state almost as long as the state has been a state. The sort of old fisherman's tale that goes around Iowa is that the farmers needed something to do in the winter when they had gotten done tossing bales of hay and decided to toss each other around. Why it took hold, though, I think, is that the sport in some ways replicates a lot of the values of Iowans. It's an agrarian state that is predicated on hard work, a lot of it solitary, certainly for the private farmers. And I think they found in that sport a little bit of a complement to their lives.
Well, I was just going to observe that the other sports and states that you mentioned, the sports are team sports, football and basketball.
Indeed.
But wrestling just pairs one person against another.
Yeah, and in very stark fashion, too, in the Iowa high school model, what happens is when a meet occurs and you and I walk out the wrestling mat to face one another, they dim the house lights and a single spotlight trains down on the mat. So you really are utterly and completely alone in your moment of competition, and exposed. You know, if something goes horribly wrong, there's a spotlight on you to record your misdeed.
Mark Kreidler, sports writer, his new book is 4 Days to Glory. Mark, I'd love to hear a reading from the book, and this is from the beginning of chapter one, where we're introduced to one of the two young men who
yes.
are profiled in the book.
Yeah, and his name is Jay Borschel, and he is one of the two primary characters in the book who, as I meet them, are each attempting to become four-time state champions. In Iowa, that's a rare feat, enough for them to be joining an extremely short list and essentially become immortal. Your name goes up on the wall and it never comes down. In this particular scene, though, what I'm conveying is the fact that he's so good, other teams no longer want to wrestle against him. And that's a problem for someone who's trying to get ready to wrestle. The chapter begins, Jay doesn't plan on his headgear ricocheting across the wrestling mat and spiking against one of his teammates' legs, but he won't be racing over to do anything about it either. You can hear the slap of plastic on skin from across the gym when it makes contact. But since the teammate caught in the crossfire is both an underclassman and a varsity wrestler in the state of Iowa, he does not so much as throw Jay a look. The boy instead sits there in his chair, alongside the mat, hunkered down, the hood of his sweat top pulled around his head to shadow his face. He does not move. There is, his position suggests, no sting from the spiked headgear, no red mark on his leg from the point of contact. Nothing has happened. And Jay need not apologize for what is essentially nothing. But Jay means it, of course, not the ricochet, but the rest of it. He wants his disgust fully visible to anyone inside the gym, which is why he yanks off the equipment and fires it downward in the first place. Let there be no question about his mood after another forfeit. He has sat with the rest of the Linmar team on a yellow and black school bus for 2 solid hours while it shuddered and skidded along the icy rural roadways from Marion to Dubuque, and he's done it because he desperately wants the moment that now eludes him. He wants to get out there and beat somebody to death. He wants to wrestle. He needs it. There's no sense in pretending anything else.
That's Mark Kreidler reading from his new book, 4 Days to Glory. It was just published today. It's a dramatic passage that you write about there. And when he says he wants to beat somebody to death, it's such a strong statement. Does he really want to beat somebody to death?
There is a competitive fury inside wrestlers that is hard to describe. And it is essentially, very essentially, a sport of managing pain. It's a question of how much pain you're willing to endure and whether or not you can inflict a greater amount of pain on your opponent. Someone finally yields to pain. That's wrestling in a nutshell. And that kind of mentality is what you have to carry on to the mat, unless you want to get hurt, frankly.
And how do they contain that aggression so that it doesn't spill out from the sport?
You know, it's interesting. The kids that I met in Iowa who wrestle are, by and large, stoics. And I think it's because it's a sport of deprivation so much of the time. They have to, in order to maintain their training weight, for example, deny themselves simple pleasures. You know, adequate hydration comes to mind, but a decent meal sometimes for days at a time, because they're carefully measuring every single piece of food in order to manage this weight. It's a sport that's built on an amount of discipline that other athletes would find probably overly rigorous, even beyond normal training methods, and it leads to a sort of inverted view. They're very much insiders. They process so much inside themselves. The mat's the only place they really express it.
How much time did you spend in Iowa?
I was there 2 months in the winter of 2005.
Cold?
I can't begin to tell you. I had some new experiences there, let's put it that way. But I never did put a car in a ditch. So all in all, I think I came out okay.
How did the people that you talked with treat you? How did you win their trust? Because here you are, a guy who works for a medium-sized newspaper in California, covers pro sports and major sporting events. Why did they think that they could trust their story and their passion with you?
Yeah, I haven't got the slightest idea. Not only that, we had actually, and this was just a fluke, I had put together what I thought was a proposal for a very interesting book about Iowa, but we sold it much ahead of schedule. The book was sold before I ever went to Iowa to even meet the families. So we were sort of walking a tightrope. But I think, you know, I grew up in Oklahoma, and my state is much like Iowa in the sense of how people receive you. They simply lack the pretense to ever, you know, appear too busy for you. And I will say, in my entire time in Iowa, up to and including, you know, this now at the point where the book's being released, there's never been a person who ever said to me, A, why would you want to do that? Or B, what's in it for me? Essentially, the gist of the conversation ran to, you know, well, you better come on out to the house then.
You said that the book was sold before you'd actually started work on it, and you're not from Iowa and you don't cover wrestling. How did you know that there was really a book there?
Well, I had the sense because I had read enough about the Iowa high school state tournament. The wrestling tournament in Iowa at the state level is unlike anything else. It's larger than any event of its kind in the United States. And it's a crowd of about 11,000 every session for seven sessions over 4 days in an arena, basically broken down into groups of about 80, because they're all coming from every tiny town in Iowa that happened to qualify a wrestler to the state tournament. It's a real chaotic sort of event with eight wrestling mats all occur going off at the same time. And there's a sense of emotion, you know, that's very palpable. And I had read about it and seen it described. My feeling was there's got to be a story there somewhere. And when I began to make a few calls, it didn't take long for me to run into the stories of these two extraordinary kids who had a chance to do something, again, very historic and extremely difficult, not only because it's a tough physical feat, but because they were carrying the weight of their community's hopes on their backs all the way through it.
Tell us a bit more about what these young men have to do to succeed in high school wrestling.
Well, they've got to, first of all, be willing to put wrestling above everything else. They have to be willing to dedicate mornings and evenings. It was interesting that while I was there, the wrestlers made it clear that among other high school athletes, they consider only swimmers to have the slightest idea what they go through in terms of the workload that's required just to get to the mat. In these guys' particular case, they also had to deal with, as was, you know, as I described at the opening of this chapter, the fact that other wrestlers no longer want to wrestle them. They're known quantities. They are a wrestler to be avoided, wrestled away from. And teams will sometimes simply forfeit the weight rather than have a decent wrestler go out there and get his ego crushed.
Elite high school basketball players, football players, baseball players, tennis players, golf players, everyone like that, many of them will say, you know, I'm at least going to go and do this at a competitive level at college, and who knows, maybe I could even make a living from it. Is that much of an option for these wrestlers in Iowa?
No, and I think it's one thing that drew me there. There's no pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And for that matter, you know, I don't have the heart to tell them, but you know, these guys probably don't realize that they'll never be more loved than they just were when they were seniors in high school competing for a town that truly knows them, that truly appreciates them, and that truly cares about the result. They wrestle for the love of the sport. Yeah, they're going on to college and they're wrestling in college, but it's not quite the same. And when college is done, they're done. There's no pro wrestling of the sort that they practice.
Mark Kreidler's new book is 4 Days to Glory, Wrestling with the Soul of the American Heartland. What are the two young men that you profiled doing now? I mean, to this day, have you kept in touch with them?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I'm right in the middle of writing a piece for ESPN magazine about where their story has gone. Very interesting twist. They were actually, when I met them, in the midst of a controversy because they had committed to, although they grew up in Iowa, to a program in Virginia at Virginia Tech University, which caused a great furor and a great upset in the state of Iowa, where all the truly great homegrown wrestlers stay home and compete for Iowa or Iowa State. Long story short, and it's the epilogue to this book, they wind up back at Iowa, which is where they are now, competing for the program that they dreamed of competing for growing up, but not without controversy.
You were until recently a writer for the Sacramento Bee. You officially left the paper on Friday. Why did you leave the paper?
Well, things are changing, and
as Ari Graswitz told us yesterday,
is it was time to go? A good enough answer. I think, you know, I had done largely the same thing for 15 years. I had some great opportunities that I wasn't 100% sure would be there a year from now, but they were there now, and I wanted to go pursue them. And I also think that, you know, I think change is good. I think life is about change. And sometimes it changes on your schedule, and sometimes it changes when you least expect it. And in my case, I had the option of making that change happen on my own schedule, and that's what I chose.
Well, you got your book out. What are your other plans?
Well, I'm doing a lot of work now for ESPN, and that occupies the vast majority of my time. They're a very important client for me going forward, and I'll wind up spending a lot of time with them. This book is only released today, so we have an awful lot of promotional work ahead, and then we'll be getting started on the next one. So there's lots going on in that realm too. I'm I don't get to have any days off since I quit my job.
And you got an early morning coming up on the CBS Early Show.
Yeah. We're very excited about that. We get on a plane tomorrow morning, fly to New York, and Thursday we'll do CBS with, I believe, Harry Smith.
That's pretty big that they're flying you out for a morning network show.
I would say it runs into the shocking category for a book about wrestling, but I decided about a month ago to stop asking any questions related to why CBS would have me on their show. We're just going to go and, you know, genuflect when we get there.
What about the Sacramento Kings? Are they going to have to be blown up at the end of the season?
That's a great question. I really think that before this is all over, I still think we'll probably see Ron Artest traded out simply because he's the most marketable tool they've got. So, yeah, I think we'll see a different-looking team before the end of the season. And at this point, I doubt anyone would argue that that's, you know, a viable option.
What do you think is going to happen about the arena? Do you think there'll be an arena? And if there isn't, what happens?
You know, for the longest time, I felt that it was very much indeterminate. I really believe now, without any great reason to believe it, that an arena deal will get made here. I think the Kings will stay long term. I do have a couple reasons that make a little sense. One is that this is a very good market for the NBA. Financially and otherwise. It's a good market. It's a good crowd market. It's an excellent NBA experience. And on the other hand, it would be extremely embarrassing to the league to have to pull a team out of a town that has consistently sold out its games. This is not the kind of thing the league will do. That's why David Stern and his people have become involved front and center in the negotiations instead of laying back and hoping things worked out. And I think their involvement probably, you know, foreshadows a favorable result.
And just one other fairly timely sports issue. There was the recent annual election to the Baseball Hall of Fame, and Mark McGwire, one of the most famous names in baseball in the late 90s, he fell far short, needed to be named on at least 75% of the ballots cast, only got 23.5%. I understand, tell me if it's correct, that you are a voting member of the Baseball Writers Association of America and you did not vote for Mark McGwire.
That's
Is that
correct.
Right?
Yeah.
And why did you not vote for such a famous player?
My reasoning on it is pretty straightforward, and that is that I do believe every available evidence suggests that he used performance-enhancing drugs repeatedly over a several-year period, which coincides with the greatest home run hitting period of his life. Now, setting that moral question aside, I'm left as a voter to look at his career. Let's assume that he doesn't bash all of those home runs. If you look at Mark McGwire's career numbers, he would only go in the Hall of Fame as a home run hitter. He doesn't go in the Hall of Fame as a fielder, a base runner. He was not a high average hitter. He was a home run hitter. And that's been enough to get people in the Hall of Fame. But as my judgment was that he achieved those numbers by use of actually things that are illegal in the United States, to say nothing of banned in baseball, it was impossible to give the vote.
Mark, your book, you have a signing tonight in Sacramento, 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock at the Borders at Fair Oaks, Fair Oaks, I should say.
And then next week in Davis at the Avid Reader.
Next Friday night, February 2nd at the Avid Reader.
And then off to Iowa.
Yes. And then, you know, I can't get enough of those Iowa winters. So this time I'm taking the family so that Colleen, Patrick, and Ryan can get an absolute experience of what it feels like when the wind actually does get through all of your clothes, no matter how many you put on.
Sports writer Mark Kreidler, his new book is 4 Days to Glory, Wrestling with the Soul of the American Heartland. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today.
You bet, Jeffrey. Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, the great jazz organist, Joey DeFrancesco. He's in town for a week of concerts at Mondavi. You'll meet this master of the Hammond B3 organ when we return. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Organist Joey DeFrancesco is one of the great names in jazz today, in town for a week of concerts at Mondavi. Here's Joey DeFrancesco on his latest album, Organic Vibes. Joey DeFrancesco is best known for his work on the classic Hammond B3 organ. He's from Philadelphia, the son of Papa John DeFrancesco, another B3 man. Joey was also long associated with Jimmy Smith, the late jazz organ great who spent most of his latter years in Sacramento. Their last work together was the 2005 album Legacy. Joey plays this week at the Mondavi Center with his trio. He's in our studio. Joey DeFrancesco, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, you drove here from the coast. How was Santa Cruz this morning?
It was okay. It was a little chilly last night, but it was beautiful this morning.
Yes. You started playing the Hammond organ and music, I guess, in general when you were quite young. Was that because of your father?
Definitely, because my father plays, and we had the B3 Hammond organ in the house, and all the great records of the greats like Jimmy Smith and Groove Holmes and Jack McDuff and Jimmy McGriff and et cetera, et cetera. We had all these records, so with that sound on the record player and the instrument in the house, I was naturally attracted to the instrument at a very young age.
Do you think you might have picked up a different instrument if it wasn't for the fact that your father played the Hammond too?
I don't know. I often think that, but sometimes I think I was really born to play that instrument.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
And was jazz always in your mind and in your heart, or did you try out, do you still try out, try yourself out in other kinds of music?
Oh, yeah. I have a lot of different interests. And there's many different influences. And even when I'm playing jazz, when I'm improvising, there's several influences and different styles of music that I just kind of put in a funnel and mix them all together, you know?
Yes. But we've got quite a few clips of your music coming up on the program. But I'd like to start with hearing you, with your trio, playing a song called Olio. This is from an album called The Philadelphia Connection. This is you playing in a trio, unlike your most recent album. Is that similar to the sound that people can expect at the Mondavi gigs this week?
Yes, but I also have a vocalist with us too, a female vocalist.
Oh, yeah?
Along with it. But yeah, this the trio sound is very much what you'll hear.
Okay, here's a bit of Olio. I read that the Hammond organ, when it was invented earlier in the 20th century, that the inventor thought of it as an organ for churches. How did it become a jazz instrument?
Well, it was originally invented, like you said, for an inexpensive alternative to pipe organs, because pipe organs were very expensive even then. So Lawrence Hammond, the inventor, came out with this instrument in 1934, and it did a good thing for the churches, but what it had that the pipe organ didn't have was a very fast attack. So when you play a note, it immediately plays. But it's not like a pipe organ. So it lent itself to playing jazz, because you could play fast phrases and pop music too. And then with the invention of the Leslie speaker, a few years after that organ came out, it was that was a marriage made in heaven. So Hammond organ and Leslie speaker became the standard for all popular music till this day.
Yeah, you play the piano too, and I'm sure you've played other kinds of keyboards. Is the Hammond organ your favorite keyboard for playing jazz?
Definitely, no question. That sound. And nowadays, so many different instruments make a Hammond sound. You don't even know, if it is a Hammond, but a Hammond sound is definitely. But the original Hammond B3 is my favorite thing to play.
Mm. You started playing the Hammond when you were young, and I read that when you were a kid in Philadelphia, you were starting to work professionally at what age?
Around 8, 9, like that.
Pretty young.
Yes.
Was that part of your plan when you were young to become a professional jazz musician, or did you just sort of drift into it?
No, I knew when I started playing when I was 4 years old, I knew immediately that I wanted to pursue this as my lifetime career.
What did the adult jazz musicians in Philadelphia make of this kid coming, playing gigs and getting money?
I think they got a kick out of me because they were all really nice to me, and I got to play with some great musicians that were very helpful to me and taught me a lot of things that I needed to know, and it was really something.
And you played with Miles Davis. You toured with Miles Davis, didn't you? And you're still pretty young.
17 years old, yeah. Yeah, I got lucky to do that. I mean, that was... After that, I didn't even go to college. I should have, but I didn't. But Miles was something else, and you learn so many things just from listening to him on the record. And then to be around him, be able to ask him questions and pick his brain was a whole other experience.
Your latest album, Organic Vibes, is so called because Bobby Hutcherson, the great vibraphonist, is also playing on it. What's it like playing with someone of such great stature? Because your name's in the cover of the album. How do you accommodate that when you're playing with someone as great as Bobby Hutcherson, but it's still a Joey DeFrancesco album?
Well, I just played with Bobby last night. He played with us in Santa Cruz. I don't know. You know, the musicians, when you play with them and you enjoy playing with each other, they make you feel so comfortable that at the moment of the music, you know, you feel on a level similar to each other. But it's when you're not playing and you start thinking about it, wow, this legendary guy is up here. Somehow you're able to zone into the music and not think about that, because if you didn't, you might not be able to play. You might choke, you know.
Yes. My guest is Joey DeFrancesco, the jazz organist. He and other members of his trio were playing all this week at the Mondavi Center in Davis. Let's listen to a bit of one of your solos on the album Organic Vibes, and this is from the first track, The Tackle. That's Joey DeFrancesco on The Tackle from his album Organic Vibes. Tell us, if you can, what's in your mind when you are about to start a solo? How much of the solo, if any of it, do you have in your mind, in your fingers when you go into it?
None of it, really. It's all improvised. I mean, there's things that you do after playing a certain amount of time that you have that are kind of in your vocabulary. Signature things that you play that you're available to you at any time. But there's a certain set of chord changes that you have to play over and improvise to make sense harmonically.
Because of the structure of the song.
Exactly. So it's just automatic. It's just there. After playing for, you know, a certain amount of time, you just do these things unconsciously. And nothing. Some guys do work out solos, though, and practice them. And I've never been one to do that because I just can't do it.
You know? You said that there are certain signature sounds that you rely on, and I can understand that. How does any musician stop leaning on those too much so that it becomes something that becomes too easy? Because the solos is obviously meant to be a creative expression.
Yeah, you shouldn't always be playing licks or cliches.
Yeah.
You want to play different things and be innovative, and so yeah, you want to be careful not to quote yourself too much even.
The speed that you're playing in that solo is astonishing. It's hard to even make out some of the individual notes. Is it easier or harder to play at that kind of speed?
I don't know. Maybe
than when you're playing at a slower, more lyrical speed.
Well, you know, when you're playing slower, to make it groove and feel good and have a vibe to it, that's the hardest thing.
Yeah.
Playing fast, I don't think is as hard, although a lot of people would disagree because they can't do it. But I think the real thing is the stuff that moves you emotionally, not so much speed, you know.
Yeah. Well, you're most famous, of course, as an organist, but you do play at least one other instrument, the trumpet, right?
Yes.
How do you rate yourself as a trumpet player?
I guess I'm okay.
Well, we have you playing trumpet here on Freddie Freeloader, which is a song from your father's album, Hip Cake Walk. Did your dad ask you to play trumpet on the album, or did you suggest it?
No, he asked me to play on it.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's hear a bit, and then we'll talk about the trumpet. It's so different from the Hammond organ. At what point did you pick up the trumpet and why?
Well, when I was playing with Miles and watching him every night and hearing that sound, it made me want to get a trumpet. So when I was 17, I got off that tour and then went home and bought a trumpet.
Wow. Did you tell Miles?
Oh, yeah. And then after I was playing for about 8 or 9 months, I actually played in front of him. And he was very encouraging. Yeah. He told me I sounded like him. And he gave me his mouthpiece. So I kept playing after that, you know. But I kind of hear that way when I play the trumpet. I can't really play any other way. I just love the way to sound like Miles. And I figure since it's not my main instrument, it's not important for me to have a style on it.
Yeah. Do you play the trumpet much on stage?
I used to play a lot more. I haven't played too much that lately, and I have to get it back together because that's not really the kind of instrument you can lay off of. Yeah.
you also sing.
Yes.
Yeah, pretty good. We pulled a track of you singing. This is from Singing and Swinging, which was an album where you obviously were going to be singing on the album. Was that how do you feel about singing? Is that something you feel comfortable doing on stage?
Oh yeah, I love it. I have a ball doing it in front of a big band. You know, I'm a big fan of Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett and guys like that, Sammy Davis Jr. So that was a whole other side of me that I've done since I was a little kid. So when I got the opportunity to make that record, I was really excited.
Well, here's my guest Joey DeFrancesco singing on "You'd Be So Nice to Come Home To."
You'd be so nice to come home to. You'd be so nice by the fire, with a breeze on high, singing a lullaby. You'd be all, baby, I ever could desire. Under the stars, chilled by the winter, under an August moon, burning above. You'd be so nice, you'd be awfully like paradise to come home to and love.
I love your voice, and it sounds like it must have been a lot of fun.
Oh, I had a ball doing that. Yeah. At the Capitol Recording Studios in L.A., you know, with the whole band. I did it live right with the band. I thought I was Frank Sinatra that day.
Were you sitting at your Hammond?
No, I was standing up. Well, yeah, the Hammond was there.
Yeah.
And then I would, like, stand up to sing and then sit back down.
It's got to be different standing up in front of a microphone singing as opposed to sitting down and behind the Hammond.
Oh, yeah. It's completely different, but fun.
Yeah, now speaking of singing, we checked out another of your recent albums just from a few years ago called Joey DeFrancesco featuring Joe Dogs.
Yes.
There's a picture of a dog in the front, but the dog represents someone else.
Joe Pesci.
Is the actor, is he a friend of yours?
Yes, he is.
And he sings?
Yes.
Yeah, and he sings pretty well, too.
Yeah, in the style of Little Jimmy Scott.
Oh,
that's
okay.
That's totally what he comes from.
Well, we pulled a clip from that. Here's Joey DeFrancesco with Joe Dogs, but really Joe Pesci with All or Nothing at All.
All
half of love never appealed to me. If your love never could yield to me, then I'd rather have nothing at all.
Was it Joe Pesci's idea to do this album or yours?
It was his. He came to me and he said he wanted to get together and do some singing. And he was a fan of mine. Yeah. And, of course, I'm a fan of his. I love his movies.
Yeah.
So I said, okay. So we got together and we were rehearsing, going over songs, just kind of messing around. And he said, maybe we'll do some jobs, some gigs together, some nice stuff. So I said, well, I'll tell you, why don't we, you know, I'll talk to my record company. Why don't we make a record, you know? And so we did. And that's really as far as it went. He came and sat in with me a couple times and stuff like that. But we never actually did any kind of anything that, you know,
sure,
big performances. But it was fun doing it. And I think he's doing another one now.
Really?
Under his own name.
Yeah. Oh, okay. What can people expect to hear at your concerts this week at the Mondavi, the start tonight?
Well, you're going to hear my trio with Jake Langley, who's on guitar, who's been with me for about 3 years now,
mm-hmm,
and Byron Wookie Landham on the drums, who's been playing with me like 18 years, and Colleen McNabb on vocals on a couple tunes set. And it's going to be nice. I have my Hammond, and I have some other keyboards now that I'm using, too, for some different sounds, and we're going to have a good time. It'll be some swinging and high energy and funky, everything.
Great. Joey DeFrancesco, concerts at the Mondavi Center in Davis, Tuesday through Saturday evenings at 8 in the Studio Theater. And Joey's going to stick around with us. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, we'll remember the late Jimmy Smith, another great jazz organist who was a musical mentor to Joey. Smith lived many of his latter years in Sacramento. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison.
Okay, one, two. You know what to do. And
our guest, jazz organist Joey DeFrancesco, played often with the late jazz great Jimmy Smith, a fellow master of the Hammond B3 organ. Here they are in their last work together, the 2005 album Legacy. This song is .com Blues. Jimmy Smith passed away in 2005. He spent most of his latter years living in Sacramento. We're going to recall Jimmy Smith with Joey DeFrancesco and others who met him. Joey, how important is Jimmy Smith in the history of jazz organ?
How important? The most important. He really created the whole style that we all followed after him. I mean, before him, there were guys that played, you know, because he was influenced by Wild Bill Davis. And, of course, Fats Waller played, and it was Milt Buckner. But Jimmy played a different way. His left hand was like a bass, and his foot was the combination bass foot. And his right hand was more like a horn player, you know. And he had an incredible fire and swing and bluesy feel. And he could play anything he thought of. And really, there was nobody close.
How old were you when you first heard Jimmy Smith and related to what he was doing?
The first time I heard him and related to, probably around 4.
I was young.
When I felt, wow, this, it was the Sermon, the record that he did from 1957. And I heard that and it just, whew, you know, I was hearing it when I was in a womb, you know, because mm-hmm. of my dad, you know, but When I really paid attention to it, I got a record player for Christmas, little one, and I just was looking for anything to put on this record player. So the first thing I pulled out was this record and put it on, and I couldn't stop listening to it.
And when did you first meet Jimmy?
When I was 7.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In our studio with us also is Mick Martin, the blues musician and KXJZ blues DJ. He knew and worked with Jimmy Smith because Jimmy lived for many years in the Sacramento area. Mick, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you. It's great to be here and talking about Jimmy because, like Joey, it was a seminal moment in anybody's life, you know, to hear Jimmy for the first time and to really have that wash over you because I always tried to, you know, I finally figured out a way to describe it. Listening to Jimmy Smith was like being in a fast car without going anywhere. I mean, you felt motion. You felt this incredible sense of energy. And he created the language. It's like somebody who actually created a language of music, you know, himself. Everybody after Jimmy Smith, that little piece of what he did, they'd pick their little part, you know, of the great jazz organ players. Joey's one of the few who plays all of the pieces.
Give us a memory you have of Jimmy Smith.
Oh, my God. I mean, there's so many of them. From the standpoint of playing with him, there was one night we were playing out at this. It was like sort of a handball place, you know, where you would go and work out and stuff, and they'd booked a gig there. And I went a fourth time on my solo. Well, usually you do three, right? And Jimmy gave me this look like, oh, you think you're smart, huh? So seven times. It was just like somebody put a rocket on my back and shot me through a roof. I learned more in one night about playing from Jimmy Smith than I'd learned in my entire life.
Joey, what's it like playing with him? Mick just told us what it's like playing with Jimmy Smith. You played obviously a lot with him.
It's incredible because especially when we were playing together, you know, these last couple, the last 6 months, like when we made that record, we played a lot of gigs together. We did like Catalina's in L.A. for a week and we played some other places, long engagements. And Jimmy had an incredible ego if you talk to him about himself. And the thing is most of it was right. So it's accepted. But when he, you know, but when we play together, I've played with other organ players, and they never listened, and they would always step on you and overplay. Oh. And the greatest jazz organist in the world who comes across with this huge ego was the most humble, listening, musical guy you could ever imagine. He was on the other organ, and he was just playing real quiet chords behind me, listening to everything I was doing. Never did it jumped on me, let me finish. It was just incredible. I mean,
a couple of years back, you recorded an album with Jimmy Smith, and that was, I guess, his last recorded
piece,
wasn't it? This is Legacy, the album called Legacy. Let's hear a bit more of Jimmy Smith. This is him soloing on the track Jonesin' for Alvin. Mick Martin, do you hear the blues in this?
Well, this is the blues. I mean, in fact, that was the one thing that was missing for me as far as the blues was concerned. When I was a kid, you know, it was a choice of buying the latest Muddy Waters, the latest Animals, or the latest Jimmy Smith. Invariably, it was Jimmy Smith. And I'd like to add something to what Joey said. As an instrumentalist who doesn't play the same instrument, Jimmy would continually change what he was playing behind you, listening to what you were doing to make you play better.
Yep.
I've never played with anybody who's had that kind of ability to make you the best that you can be. It was totally unselfish.
Was he doing that deliberately?
No. Oh, yeah. I don't know if it was deliberate.
Well, he felt it.
It was just there.
It's just like
natural.
Channeling, you know?
Yeah. Our final guest is on the phone. He's Marcus Crowder. He's a Sacramento Bee theater critic, but he also writes about jazz. In the late 90s, he profiled Jimmy Smith for the Sacramento News and Review. Marcus, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks, Jeffrey. It's great to be on the show.
Why did Jimmy Smith move to Sacramento? Because he wasn't from here.
You know, I'm not exactly sure why he did, but I think there was something about he wanted a little bit more laid back lifestyle. I think from what he had been living in, and I think he got a good deal on a house out in Carmichael. So he and his wife moved here.
What was he like as a person? You spent some time with him when you were talking with him.
Well, yeah, I, I met him one time. I saw him play several times around here, but I got to come out to his house once to do a story on him. And yeah, I had been warned that he could be difficult or kind of gruff. And his wife met me at the door and said, you know, he just got up from his nap, and you know, he might try and mess with you a little bit, but you know, just stick with it, and it'll be okay. And so I met him, and he kind of feigned like he wasn't really interested in talking to me. And then I'm not quite sure what I asked him about, but I kind of asked him about how he developed his style. And he just started tapping his left leg, and he said, "It's all here. It's all here. It's all it's all in my leg." He said that was my innovation. That's what I did. And then after that, he was just a lot of fun. He just started showing. He was really proud of his house. He had TVs in every room, and he showed me all the TVs. And he had a wall full of Downbeat plaques for winning Downbeat awards for about 20 straight years.
What kind of gigs was he playing in Sacramento?
Yeah, he did all kinds of things, and I'm sure Mick knows better. But I know he played just a lot of sort of casual gigs with some local musicians, and then every now and then he'd go out on the road with some guys I think he knew from L.A. who he'd go out and do some national tours with.
Mick, was he playing big gigs? I mean, he was a big name, but was he playing small gigs just for the sake of doing something?
Well, he played a lot around Sacramento at the Ortiz. The names changed. Savannah's, you know, he did a recording, and they almost did a documentary at Savannah's, which is in the Sacramento Inn. Jimmy would just show up sometimes when Johnny Hartsman was playing, and Johnny, being a smart man, would get off the organ, let Jimmy take over and play some guitar. And Johnny Hartsman was a great organ player, too. So Jimmy was sometimes ubiquitous, and sometimes he'd be on tour of Europe, and you wouldn't see him at all, so...
Joey, did you know Jimmy before he moved to Sacramento?
Oh, yeah. I knew Jimmy. When I first met Jimmy, well, I met him in New York, but he was living in L.A. at the time.
What did you think when he moved to Sacramento?
Well, before,
be truthful, Joey.
Well, he moved all over. He was in L.A., then he went to Nashville.
Right, and he hated the frogs in the pool, and he moved.
Yeah, and then he went to Sacramento.
Right.
And he was in Sacramento for a long time. I didn't really, I don't know. My brother, I visited Sacramento a couple times because my brother was at Travis Air Force Base, and I loved it. I thought it was beautiful, so I kind of understood.
But not in the jazz mainstream.
No, I live in Phoenix, Arizona.
You do?
Yeah.
And that's where Jimmy went, spent his last couple of years, didn't he?
No, not even. A little less than a year after he moved there, he passed away.
Did he move there because he knew he was towards the end?
I'm not sure why. No, because Lola was still alive when they moved. I'm not sure why they moved there. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think for the weather, you know, because Lola was sick a lot. And, and she only lasted a couple months after they moved there. So.
Okay, well, let's just wrap this up by going around our guests. What's to recommend to someone that's not familiar with Jimmy Smith, a great Jimmy Smith song to start listening to? We'll start with... Joey DeFrancesco.
Oh, man. There's so many of them. It's the hardest thing in the world to say. But I think any listener would love listening to, like, The Sermon.
Yeah, that was the one you listened to when you were four.
Yeah, the original with Art Blakey, you know, Kenny Burrell, and Lee Morgan, and George Coleman.
Marcus Crowder, any favorite Jimmy Smith songs?
I really love his King of the Road.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah,
Wes.
Yeah, exactly.
Great. And Mick Martin?
I'm with the Cat. That's the one that won in the Grammy Award, and the whole record is an experience in itself. But let's face it, Jimmy Smith never made a bad record.
No. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you all so much. We've been talking about Jimmy Smith. My guests in the studio, Mick Martin, the blues musician, and KXJZ blues DJ. On the phone, Marcus Crowder, writer for the Sacramento Bee. And in our studio again, Joey DeFrancesco, who, to remind you, is in town for a week of concerts at the Mondavi Center in Davis, Tuesday through Saturday evening at 8 o'clock. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tomorrow in Insight, prominent civil rights activist Anne Fagan Ginger tells you about her new paths for action. Coming up on the KXJZ station, some West Bank Palestinians aren't allowed to drive on Israeli roads, so what ought to be a 13-minute drive to work takes an hour and a quarter on foot, in cabs, and through security checkpoints. That's the morning commute, Palestinian style, and the day's news next on The World. Insight staff includes Mark Jones, Natalie Breen, Jen Picard, and Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Special thanks today to Paul Conley for musical assistance with our Joey DeFrancesco interview. And thank you for joining us. When students download unlicensed music on campus, it can cause big legal problems both for themselves and for their schools. Next time in Insight, you'll hear how some local universities are responding to the problem. Also, a prominent civil rights activist is speaking in Sacramento. Anne Fagan Ginger tells you about her new paths for action. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join us for Insight.
That's tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.